Students heading off to college now have lots of decisions to make about which courses to take, but a course on personal finance isn't even an option at many schools. That's despite the fact that many undergraduates leave school tens of thousands of dollars in debt. Youth Radio's Ariel Edwards-Levy reports that many college students don't even know what they need to know about money.
When Fahia Rashid started college at UC Irvine, she thought she knew most of the financial traps to avoid. Chatting at an LA coffee shop, she says her father's experience taught her to watch her spending.
When he was in college, he went crazy. He had like 18 different credit cards. He took student loans, and now he's almost 50, still paying that money back, and there's not a stop to it. So he told me, you know, just limit yourself to one or two cards and spend very wisely. Do not spend money you don't have.
But during her freshman year, Rashid faced an unexpected problem.
When you start school, they give you a whole bunch of loans. They're like, okay, take this, take that, take this. And I was under the impression that I needed all of that money. So I said yes to every single one of them, which was a bad idea. And of course.
She returned as many of the unnecessary loans as possible, about $3,000 worth. Rashid figures the less she borrows now, the better off she'll be after years of compounding interest. Problems like hers are common, says financial expert Kathy Kristoff, because students aren't taught about money.
Most of them are pretty clueless when they first start college, unless their parents have been really doing a great job about educating them about finance all along. We just don't get much financial education in high school, and then parents send their kids off to college, kind of like, you know, pushing them out of the nest.
Kristoff, who wrote the book Taming the Tuition Tiger, says the biggest mistake students make is getting into too much debt, especially by taking out private student loans. She says the loans are easy to confuse with federal loans, but they have much higher interest rates. There are other financial lessons that have to be learned through experience. USC student Arlene Washington says living on her own taught her to budget. She learned to save money for hidden fees on things like student government, as well as for smaller purchases.
When you're living with your parents, you don't know everything that comes into what you need to support yourself. So then once you go on your own, there might be certain things, even as little as toilet tissue.
She says her best lessons in finance came from her job on campus.
Because, you know, you would get your check at a certain time of the month, and then if you get that check, you say to yourself, well, how much can I spend or how much do I need to use on certain things monthly? Mm-hmm. Whether it be bills or, you know, different things. I need to buy food, things like that.
Financial expert Kristoff says making sure kids have jobs is one way parents can teach them about money, but it has to be part of a larger conversation.
If you've been all along, all through high school, talking to your kids about money, it's good to let them fly solo right now and take the responsibility for their finances. If you know you haven't done that, then you want to wean them from your protection over time.
Kristoff sees no fast way to make college-bound students financial pros. But she says learning how to manage money is as important as what you learn in the classroom. For NPR News, I'm Ariel Edwards-Levy.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. The race to the top is now over. The U.S. Department of Education awarded $3.4 billion in grant money yesterday to nine states and to Washington, D.C., The race pitted states against each other for that money. To win, they had to pitch the most compelling plans for education reform. Some states made big changes in an effort to win, and so for the losers, the question now is, what to do? Where will they get the money that they'd hoped would come from the federal government? And for some of those answers, we turn now to Barbara O'Brien, who is Lieutenant Governor of Colorado. Welcome.
Hello.
Colorado finished just outside the money. Many people felt you would likely win. What happened, you know?
We were hearing from national experts who read all of their proposals that we should end up in the top two, three, or four in the whole country. They loved our proposal, and they thought we had very bold, doable plans. So all we can figure out is that, yet again, Western states that have a little different way of doing things just, you know, we have a bunch of reviewers who don't understand that there's a different way of life than the East Coast.
But when you speak of bold, doable plans, in a nutshell, what were you going to do, and can you do them now without the money from Race to the Top?
We had passed the most far-reaching teacher and principal evaluation system in the whole country, and in fact, it already formed a council that was beginning to design it. So that was one piece of it. Another one was that we have one of the most robust charter school environments in the country. And that was supposedly going to give us a lot of points. That was something the Department of Education was looking favorably on. So we had really heard from people that we put ourselves out there in just the way Arne Duncan had been describing.
Well, what is the state of those reforms without federal money in the race to the top?
Some of them we can do anyway. Designing the program is really a bunch of people who understand data systems and educators who can define how you measure good teaching. They're already working and they'll continue working. We are going to have to look around hard for the money to actually create the data system that can then go out to every school district across the state.
The winners, it has been pointed out, have been heavily in the eastern half of the continental U.S. Hawaii was the only western state that was among the winners. You expressed some western regional resentment to that just now. What do you think of this process, which is not political? It's not about regions vying and having blocks and votes and getting a share of the money as they see as fair.
You know, I don't think it was political, but I think it was really tone deaf to the variety across the United States of America. One of the requirements, for example, was that if you had a low-performing school, you had to close it down and then reopen later in some new form. And I totally understand that for large urban districts, and we are already doing that. But we've got a lot of districts with one school in them. You know, you can't close down a school that's the only school for 60 miles and follow that format and reopen it a year later. So there were just some things written in that made it very tough for us to get all the points we needed when we have, you know, 60 of these tiny school districts, but they need to be part of this plan as well.
Is your response then, this wasn't entirely fair to the West, but we hope they'll get it right the next time they do something like this? Or do you try to somehow overturn the result and appeal it?
Oh, no, we're not going to appeal the result, but they've gotten it wrong from our perspective twice now. So I don't think they're particularly learning from these lessons. So we're going to go our own way and figure out how to keep working on this reform agenda, which is our agenda anyway. We didn't have to turn somersaults to fit in with this proposal. We were on this path. So it'll be slower, and we'll have to scramble for the funds to do it, but it's the Colorado plan.
Lieutenant Governor O'Brien, thank you very much for talking
to us. Thank
you. That's Lieutenant Governor Barbara O'Brien of Colorado, which did not win money in the race to the top.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer. With unemployment at close to 10%, work is hard enough to find. For some people, the biggest barrier to moving on to a new job is moving out of their existing home. People can't leave because they can't find a buyer or because their mortgage is underwater, meaning they owe more than their home is now worth. Historically, job opportunities have been the leading reason that people relocate. In the first of a two-part series, NPR's Yuki Noguchi looks at how the lack of mobility complicates things for people looking for jobs.
Melissa Brooks and her husband had a plan. They wanted to move from Lansing, Michigan to Atlanta to be closer to family and to improve their job prospects. But now their home is standing between them and their plans.
So everything's kind of just centered on selling this house here in Michigan, and it's been over a year now, and it has not happened, not even an offer.
Brooks has kept her career on hold so she can be ready for a move. She's also kept the house on the market, which is now a short sale, meaning it's listed for less than what they still owe on it.
Recently, I guess I've been angry at the people looking to buy my home, which sounds crazy because I want to sell the home. But I guess that's what I'm angry about. Now that it's priced this low, people are looking and they're starting to ask questions like, well, what about this? Are you going to repaint the deck? And I feel like, you know, don't ask me anything because I'm short selling this house and we're not doing anything else to it.
She says this past year has left scars. Home ownership once seemed prudent. Now Brooks feels frustrated and bitter.
I didn't expect, I guess, it to be an emotional experience to try and sell and move out of a house, but I feel like I've been burned and I feel like, you know, I don't want to open myself up to buy another house.
Renting now seems like the far more responsible choice, so they aren't locked out of taking jobs in the future. This is the fallout from the crash in the housing market. Americans who expected mobility now find themselves grounded. They can't move to better job markets without taking a huge financial hit. Real estate professor Joe Jorko at Wharton says, taken as a whole, this phenomenon is devastating to the labor market.
Outside of outright foreclosure itself and the loss of wealth, it's probably the most important impact of over-leveraging the housing market that we're going to have in this cycle.
Jorko says some markets could take many years to recover. Some people may opt to wait it out, hoping that home prices will eventually rebound, but others may simply choose to walk away.
If you need a job and you need to improve your life chances, you know, why not? I mean, it's not that it's free, it's not that it doesn't cost you, but it may be worth paying that price.
Tony Abram has considered that. The large telecom company he works for has been downsizing, so he has been looking for work elsewhere, including out of state. But he can't afford to drive far from his home in Douglasville, Georgia, and Abram says it's declined so much in price he can't afford to sell it either.
We were really ready to leave. We were painting the walls and everything and getting everything done. And that assessment just took the wind out of everything we were doing.
Abram wanted to join the Air Force, but moving for that is also out of the question. So it appears he'll be stuck for some time.
My father is buying a house 4 houses down from me, same floor plan that I have, for half the price that I paid for mine. And when I saw that, it gives me that feeling of, oh my God, I'm never going to get out of this neighborhood.
Abram hopes things won't get worse. He's willing to put his career on hold for another 2 or 3 more years and hope for the best. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News.
Visit NPR.org to see a map that has state-by-state information on underwater mortgages. And if you're trying to sell a house, we would like to hear how that's going.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. The U.S. is facing a potentially catastrophic shortage of primary care doctors and other health professionals. Now, the nation is about to expand health care coverage to tens of millions more Americans, so many more people are going to be seeking medical care, a situation that threatens to stress the system even further. Today, and for the rest of this week, we're going to explore a primary care system overwhelmed. To see how the shortage is playing out and some of the solutions being proposed, we sent NPR's Julie Rovner to Maine. It's one of the states that's leading the effort to solve this problem, and she's with us in the studio. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Robert.
From the economics textbooks, we know that shortages are caused either by too little supply or too much demand. Which is it with primary care?
Well, unfortunately, it's a bit of both. Let's start with the demand side. That would be the patients. First, we have an aging baby boom population. By the year 2030, we'll have more than 70 million seniors. One of every 5 Americans will be over the age of 65. And as anyone who's ever been in a doctor's waiting room knows a little too well, older people use more medical care. They have more medical problems. Then we have the good news, bad news of the new health care law, which will give an estimated 32 million more people insurance who didn't have it before. And a lot of them will be looking for primary care doctors. So it's kind of a double whammy.
That's the demand side. On the supply side, the question is, where are the doctors?
Well, doctors who are in training are going into every field except primary care. According to a report earlier this month in the New England Journal of Medicine, less than a fifth of all the students graduating from medical school this year are likely to end up practicing primary care. They're all becoming specialists.
For the money?
Well, it's partly the money. Primary care doctors, which include family practitioners, internists, and pediatricians, earned a median salary of about $191,000 last year. It's according to one major survey. That's about half of what a dermatologist earned and barely over 40% of what a cardiologist made. Now, if you graduate from medical school with student loans in the neighborhood of $200,000 or so, you can see why more and more of those students are opting to become specialists. But it's also a lifestyle choice. Primary care doctors work long hours, including nights and weekends, and it's much more emotionally demanding work than something like radiology, where you're basically looking at pictures all the time.
So what's the solution? How are we going to get enough primary caregivers for everyone who needs them?
Well, it's definitely not going to be easy, and like everything else in healthcare, there's no single answer. But there do seem to be some ideas out there, both to help people who are practicing now become more efficient and get better paid, and to help train more people.
Okay, let's then hear Julie Rovner, part one of your series. It's a profile of a member of a vanishing breed, a doctor in solo practice.
Dr. Crute and Kathy Clement's office. Can you hold for a moment?
Kathy Crute wants to get one thing straight from the get-go. She is not a dinosaur.
No. I mean, I think patients love a small practice. My receptionist can recognize a lot of patients' voices over the phone. They know who they're talking to every time. They don't have to go through a whole chain of command.
And the patients in the waiting room at her Portland office second that notion. Lori Warhol has been seeing Crute for nearly a decade.
I just think it's better service to come to the same person all the time and have one person looking overlooking you.
And it's not just Crute herself, says patient Mike Greenleaf. It's the entire atmosphere.
The staff's great, and you know, on an individual basis, it just makes you feel that much better.
Crute actually came to her solo practice late in her career. She was one of the first doctors to become a certified family practitioner. She worked in a small group for 10 years, and later a larger one.
And realized very quickly that that was not where I wanted to be.
The emphasis was on moving patients in and out as fast as possible, and she didn't feel like she had enough control. Crute said she had some friends who were solo practitioners.
I was like, well, yeah, I guess I can do it too.
That was 10 years ago. Since then, she's built a tight, efficient little team around her. So efficient, in fact, that Crute only works 3.5 days a week. She gets in at 8:15 and says she rarely leaves the office after 5:30.
David, we do have samples if you want to stop by and pick up some. You'll just have to do 2 of the 10 milligrams because we only have 5s and 10s in samples.
It's easy for the staff to know the patient, says office manager Amy Asali. Most of them have been with the practice for years. She literally inherited her job.
My mother actually was her office manager when she was in the group practice. She retired, so I hopped into the position.
Crute credits Asali with keeping the practice financially viable. Crute says Asali's always on the lookout for various hospital or state or insurance incentives to boost cash flow. But Asali, who's also answering the phones on this, the receptionist's day off, concedes her job is a challenge. Keeping a small practice afloat takes some doing these days.
Definitely a juggling act. Without having the overhead of, you know, a larger practice helping us, you know, it's a game week to week, making sure we've got enough patients on the schedule.
But Crute says as long as the bills get paid, she's okay. She says she's definitely not in this for the money.
You're not driving the latest BMW.
No. No, I'm driving a 10-year-old car.
Although she wishes she and her staff could spend less time on insurance company bureaucracy.
We have a part-time person just doing referrals. And that's a huge piece. And we also spend a tremendous amount of time on the phone with prior authorizations for medications.
That's medical speak for getting permission to prescribe a specific drug. But what really keeps Crute up at night is what will happen to her practice and her patients when she retires. She's 63.
Planning work in probably another 3 years.
So she's spending some of her time trying to recruit her replacement. Among her targets, the family practice residents currently in training at the nearby Maine Medical Center. She's got all their photos hanging on the bulletin board in her office, but she knows that finding one to take on a solo practice won't be easy.
It's probably going to have to be someone that doesn't have a huge debt.
Which doesn't leave a very large pool of young doctors finishing their medical training. And she's competing for those residents with local hospitals and huge doctor groups like Martin's Point, located across town. Some on her staff derisively call it Walmart. But Walmart or not, those groups can offer something she can't, some certainty that they can begin to pay back their medical school loans.
That's probably the biggest roadblock to having a small practice, because I can't guarantee somebody a salary coming out of residency.
So, for her patients and for Kathy Crute, the clock is ticking.
And Julie Rovner is here in the studio with us today. And Julie, you went to Maine because that state is leading efforts to solve this problem of the primary care shortage. What are they doing?
Well, one of the things they're doing is pioneering something called the medical home. And it's a way to bring together health professionals as a team, doctors, nurses, other types of health professionals, to really take some of these big groups. In fact, Martin's Point, one of the groups we heard about in that piece, that's right, is one of the places that's doing this. And it's really an effort to make some of these big groups act more like the very small groups that we just heard about, make it really seem more like a place where everybody knows all the patients. So that was one of the things that I really wanted to see by going to Maine.
Hence the homey name.
Indeed.
And this is what you'll be reporting on tomorrow.
Yes, I will.
Okay. And it also was summertime when you went to Maine. That was another reason for choosing it, perhaps?
It didn't hurt.
Okay, NPR's Julie Robner.
This weekend marks 5 years since Hurricane Katrina hit the Mississippi Gulf Coast and New Orleans. Many books have been written about the aftermath. Essayist Ralph Eubanks has been reading a new one called Beyond Katrina.
On one of her trips back to the Mississippi Gulf Coast after Hurricane Katrina, poet Natasha Trethewey noticed a sign in front of a Baptist church emblazoned with this command, "Believe the report of the Lord, face the things that confront you." Trethewey takes those words to heart. Like the gifted memoirist she proves to be in the pages of Beyond Katrina, a meditation on the Mississippi Gulf Coast, she indeed faces and confronts demons from her past and the present. The result is a book as moving and compelling as Trethewey's poetry. When we begin to imagine a future in which the places of our past no longer exist, we see ruin. The ruin and destruction move beyond the eroding beaches and ancient uprooted live oak trees that line the Mississippi Gulf Coast. What she explores with emotional depth and sensitivity is the psychic toll Katrina has taken on her family and the community they live in. This fall will bring a number of books to a growing body of literature on this disaster. What makes Beyond Katrina stand out in the crowded landscape of post-Katrina literature is the raw, personal nature of the story Trethewey tells, as well as the poetic language she uses to tell the tale. She moves the reader beyond the uplifting narrative of rebuilding, represented by each new glitzy casino along the shores of the Mississippi Gulf. Instead, she tells a story beyond the gambling palaces and moves a few miles from the Gulf beaches, up Highway 49, into African-American and working-class North Gulfport. North Gulfport is where Trethewey spent her summers with her grandmother as a girl, and where her brother Joe came to live after his father, Trethewey's stepfather, murdered their mother. Although her grandmother must have seen her daughter's murderer when she looked at Joe, the family somehow found a way to look beyond that personal tragedy. Perhaps to counter this perception, Joe seems to assume the persona of her grandmother's beloved brother, Son Dixon, a legendary nightclub owner and African-American entrepreneur, and immerses himself in his Uncle Son's business of owning and renovating shotgun houses in North Gulfport. Before Katrina, Joe's life and business is on track. After Katrina, forces of nature and circumstance lead to his imprisonment. To tell the story of Joe's attempt to rebuild his life and the simple tragic act that leads to his incarceration, she mixes prose, poetry, personal letters, and what few childhood photographs survive the storm. Beyond Katrina is just what the subtitle says it is, a meditation. But within this book's quiet thoughts lies a powerful story of things long gone that will never come back.
Beyond Katrina will be published next week. Ralph Eubanks is the author of Ever is a Long Time, A Journey into Mississippi's Dark Past. He's also director of publishing at the Library of Congress.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. In Los Angeles, divorces involving the rich and famous are a kind of spectator sport. But real sports fans have a special interest in a divorce case that's coming to trial next week. It involves the McCourts, Frank and Jamie. They are the husband and wife who both claim ownership of the Los Angeles Dodgers. As NPR's Karen Grigsby Bates reports, the McCourts' marital split is a dark cloud hovering over the Dodgers franchise.
Frank and Jamie McCourt met in the 70s when they were both undergraduates at Georgetown University. And in the beginning, it was like this. But after they bought the Dodgers and moved to Los Angeles, their marriage turned into something like this scene from the movie The War of the Roses.
I
am the one who found this house. I bought everything in it
with my money. It's a lot easier to spend than it is to make it, honey bun.
You might not have made it if not for me, sweet cakes.
Now they're on the verge of what promises to be a very long, very ugly divorce trial, a spectacle even in a divorce capital like L.A. The big question isn't who's getting custody of the McCourt's four children. They're all grown. But who's getting the couple's most public possession? The Los Angeles Dodgers. Frank and his lawyers say he's the team's sole owner, that Jamie got seven houses in exchange for surrendering her claim to the Dodgers. But Jamie and her lawyers say she didn't understand the true nature of the document she was signing. She trusted her husband. Mark Shanahan profiled the couple for the Boston Globe last year. He says Jamie McCourt's profession of ignorance might raise eyebrows, since she has a law degree from the University of Maryland and a business degree from MIT.
She is indeed a very shrewd businesswoman, and I think that people are on to something when they say, how could she have not known what she was signing? I think that's going to be a critical question, and I'm skeptical myself.
Dodger fans have never warmed to either McCourt, even though under the couple's ownership, the team has gone to the playoffs 4 years out of six. Bill Shaken is a sports writer who's covering the trial for the Los Angeles Times.
I think what it comes down to for fans is, yes, they're very happy that the team has been more competitive under the McCourts than it was under the previous ownership.
But, Shaken says, the McCourts' very public marital battle has caused some fans to wonder if the couple cares enough about the Dodgers' well-being.
Ever since the divorce proceedings started last October and the McCourts decided to announce their separation while the Dodgers were still trying to get to the World Series, I think there's been a sense among fans that these people have put themselves above the team.
Pre-trial discovery shows the McCourts have been living lavishly, with multiple mansions, lots of private jets, and even $14,000 a year for in-home hairstyling. Robert Frank is the author of Richistan, a book that examines the habits of the newly wealthy.
What people might resent about the McCourts is that they extracted a lot of money from that team. There's a perception that if you're going to own a sports team, you need to be investing in it rather than treating it as a giant ATM machine to buy your next mansion or private jet.
California has seen plenty of high-stakes splits, but the battle's usually over private things like cars and houses and money. Fighting over a major league jewel like the Dodgers, if it happens, takes the McCourts to a whole new level, says attorney David Rudick.
They're part of a process that in this state, it's a broken process, and it fans the flames of a divorce or a dissolution proceeding. It tends to generate its own energy.
If the McCourts can't come to an agreement, the judge might force them to unload the team. But don't expect a fire sale. By some estimates, the Dodgers are now worth about twice the $430 million the McCourts paid back in 2004. Robert Frank says people may criticize the McCourts, but they've made the Dodgers an attractive prospect for someone who can afford them.
They've done a great job raising revenues, bringing more money into the team, and as a result, I think there'd be a lot of people that would be lining up to buy the team if it were available.
The determining factor might be whether the McCourts can agree to play ball with each other. Karen Grigsby Bates, NPR News.